Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Today's date is January 20th, 2016. I am not your usual skeptical host, Ken Milne. I'm Chris Carpenter, subbing for Ken this week because I've locked Ken in the closet so he can ruminate about all things skeptical in the world. Seriously, Ken asked me to substitute this week to add the perspective of somebody who is not a co-author on the paper we're discussing. The title of today's podcast is The Use of Topical Anesthetics for Pain Control in Patients with Corneal Abrasion. Our guest skeptics today are Kara Otterness from Stony Brook University on Long Island and Salim Rezai from the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio. Kara is an assistant clinical professor of emergency medicine at Stony Brook. Salim is an associate clinical professor of emergency medicine and internal medicine at the University of Texas Health Science Center at San Antonio, Texas. He's the creator and founder of Rebel EM Blog and Rebelcast, and today is Salim's birthday. Happy birthday, Salim. Do you want Kara and I to sing for you?
let's save that for another episode.
Good choice. So welcome to both of you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Thanks for having me on.
So today we're going to talk about painful eyes. Kara, can you give us a case?
Sure. A 23-year-old healthy woman presents with right eye pain. She states she felt a foreign body sensation yesterday, and then overnight it became painful. Her visual acuity is 20/20 bilaterally, and she doesn't wear corrective lenses. Instillation of tetracaine drops results in complete resolution of the pain. On your slit lamp examination, you see a small corneal abrasion outside of the visual axis with no evidence of ulceration and no foreign body. You update the patient's tetanus, prescribe her an antibiotic drop, and prepare to discharge her when she approaches you and states, "The pain is starting to come back. Can I have that bottle of medicine you used before to take home with me?"
Yeah, this happens about once a week. Salim, is effective pain management of corneal abrasions really an issue?
Yeah, so corneal abrasions account for approximately 10% of eye-related visits to the emergency department, making them one of the most common eye-related presentations. The cornea is highly innervated, and even small abrasions can cause significant pain. So pain control is absolutely one of the fundamental goals of emergency medical care. The first documented use of topical ophthalmologic anesthetics was in 1818, a cocaine derivative that was employed to effectively block nerve conduction in the superficial cornea and conjunctiva.
However, a number of proposed dangers limit the use of topical anesthetic agents for the treatment of corneal abrasions associated pain. These dangers include delayed healing secondary to mitosis inhibition and decreased corneal sensation. The latter issue is of concern because of the potential for the abrasion to progress to an ulcer without the patient noticing. Additionally, these agents may have direct toxicity to corneal epithelium with prolonged use, leading to increased corneal thickness, opacification, stromal infiltration, and epithelial defects. The fear of these complications has led to the pervasive teaching that topical anesthetics should never be used for outpatient management of corneal abrasions. This is reflected in the condemnation of their use in major EM textbooks, including Rosen's and Tintinelli's.
So based on this, we've been reluctant to give these agents to patients, in spite of the fact that we know that they'll completely improve their pain levels.
So the clinical question then is, can patients with simple corneal abrasions be safely discharged home with a prescription for topical anesthetic drops? Kara, what's the reference for this manuscript?
Sure. The reference is Swaminathan, Otterness, Milne, and Rezai, The Safety of Topical Anesthetics in the Treatment of Corneal Abrasions, a Review. Journal of Emergency Medicine, 2015.
Do you know the authors?
Yeah, so full disclosure, we sort of know these authors in that they're us.
Okay, that's fishy.
Define know these authors. I don't, you know, when you talk about Ken, I'm not sure that we really know Ken.
Who do we ever really know?
So getting back to a more serious topic here, this was a systematic review looking at all articles in humans investigating the use of topical anesthetics in corneal abrasions. So I think we found a total of 36 citations originally, but we only included studies that were prospective in human trials using either proparacaine or tetracaine for the treatment of corneal abrasions. And so with that inclusion criteria, this limited our findings to two citations. So after reviewing all the citations in the articles we found, we also identified four additional studies that were relevant to the question. So a total of six studies were included in this review.
All of the articles we included in the systematic review are online on the SGEM blog. Table 1 represents the two ED-based studies that were relevant to our question. Table 2 includes the four studies from the ophthalmology literature. We thought that this distinction was important because the ophtho papers were actually looking at the use of topical proparacaine or tetracaine in patients who had undergone PRK, or photorefractive keratectomy. This procedure produces an injury to the cornea similar to a corneal abrasion, but it's done under surgical circumstances, so the corneal defects are not contaminated. However, if we believe that the topical anesthetics are directly toxic to the eye, or that they inhibit wound healing, the PRK data is still relevant to the discussion.
So as part of doing this study, we looked at the original articles that were used as the basis for not giving topical anesthetics. And these were all case reports and case series where the patients didn't have ocular evaluation by a physician prior to starting the drops, used the drops too frequently and or for a prolonged period of time, and often used concentrations that were far too strong. Interestingly, in the two biggest case series, and by big, we're not talking too big, we're talking series of 5 patients and 9 patients, 4 of the subjects were actually physicians.
Go figure. So as opposed to these case series, the 6 articles we included in our review had patients administer the drops at appropriate intervals and for shorter durations. So they are really using the therapy as directed. In the ED study by Ball et al., they also used a dilute solution, 1/10 of the standard concentration.
And we would have loved to do a meta-analysis on these articles, but as you can see, the heterogeneity was just way too high to even try attempting that.
Yeah, not every systematic review has to be meta-analysis. That was the appropriate decision here. So there is not a lot of evidence to support or to refute classic teaching to avoid the use of anesthetic drops in the days following an episode of Care for Corneal Abrasion. Based on what you found in the 6 articles, what were your conclusions?
So our conclusions were limited available data suggests that the use of dilute topical ophthalmologic proparacaine or tetracaine for a short duration of time is effective, though their safety for outpatient use is inconclusive.
So let's go through the quality checklist for therapeutic systematic reviews now. Question 1 is, does the clinical question, is it sensible and is it answerable?
So I would say yes. The question is discrete and it's a common ED presentation, so we should be able to get good data on it.
Number 2, is the search for studies detailed and exhaustive?
Yes. So we searched PubMed and EMBASE for citations, and additionally, we looked through all the references of the articles we located, and then we also used a medical librarian to assist us with our search.
Yeah, so kudos for using a medical librarian. A lot of systematic reviews don't do that. That's a good step. A significant number of clinical studies are never published, though, for one reason or another. For a thorough systematic review search strategy, it's also important to hand search research abstracts presented to EM meetings like SAM and ASAP each year, and probably a couple of the ophthalmology meetings as well. Another method to discover unpublished research that won't show up on PubMed or EMBASE is to search clinicaltrials.gov. Did you do so for this study?
So unfortunately, we did not search through abstracts presented at EM meetings or search the clinicaltrials.gov database.
Okay. Question 3, are the primary studies, were they of high methodological quality?
I'd say so. In particular, the 2 ED studies by Ball and Waldman were excellent from a methodology standpoint.
So putting on my critic's hat, a variety of quality assessment instruments exist for systematic reviews of interventional studies. Examples would be the Cochrane Risk of Bias Tool and the somewhat outdated Haddad Scale. It's important for systematic review authors to use validated instruments to assess individual study quality to ensure readers that are reliable, that is, it can be reproduced if 2 people rate the same study, and valid, that is, you're measuring what you think you are measuring. The assessment of quality assessment occurs before lumping the results together. Did your author group use one of these instruments? And if not, why not? And how can we be confident that the included studies were high quality?
So this could potentially be a limitation of our systematic review because we didn't use the Cochrane instrument or the Haddad scale to ensure the quality of the studies included.
Okay, fair enough. Question 4, the assessment of studies, was it reproducible?
Yes, we detailed our process in the materials and methods section.
So looking through the manuscript, I don't see anything in the methods detailing how individual study quality assessment was conducted, that is, by whom, where you said not using an instrument, and with what inter-rater reliability assessment?
So there was no formal inter-rater reliability assessment performed, but instead what we did was we each reviewed the search list individually and compared our list to find the 6 prospective human trials on the topic.
Okay. Question 5, the outcomes, are they clinically relevant?
Yes. The topical anesthetics provided analgesia and adverse outcomes were evaluated.
Question 6, there was low statistical heterogeneity for the primary outcomes.
No. So as we mentioned earlier, the studies were highly heterogeneous, and as a result, we weren't able to do a meta-analysis.
Okay. And finally, the last question, was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
We can't really say. Since we didn't do a meta-analysis, we don't have a single outcome number. In the individual trials, though, topical anesthetics were found to be effective for analgesia. However, from a safety perspective, no patients had ulcerations, corneal opacifications, or significantly delayed healing.
Okay, that's interesting by itself. What were the key results of your study?
Yeah, so the systematic review found that topical anesthetics provided good pain control with no adverse outcomes if used for 48 hours and having some sort of physician follow-up.
Okay, so we're going to go on to the SGEM commentary now. We already touched on the issue of heterogeneity, but let's talk a little bit more about whether the treatment effect was large enough, even if you were unable to perform the planned meta-analysis.
I think to address this, we should focus in on the two ED-based studies. In the study by Ball et al., the authors found a statistically significant difference in pain relief from the topical anesthetic in comparison to placebo. Patients were either given dilute proparacaine 0.05% and instructed to use it as often as they like for 7 days, or they were given a placebo drop. They were also given Tylenol with codeine for breakthrough pain. They used a visual analog scale, or VAS, to rate the pain and found a mean improvement of 3.9 in the proparacaine group and only 0.6 in the placebo group.
The second study was from Waldman et al. In this study, patients were given either 1% tetracaine or saline drops and told they could use these drops every 30 minutes for 24 hours. They were given paracetamol, or acetaminophen for those of us in the United States, for breakthrough pain. They found no significant difference in VAS score between the two groups, although the patients receiving tetracaine rated their drops as more effective in relieving pain.
Yeah, I find it very surprising that they didn't find a difference in pain scores, because this is a miracle drug. We see these patients every shift. We put the drop in and presto, the pain is gone, at least until after that initial severe stinging episode has passed.
I agree. Our experience says that this works, but in this one study, they didn't show it. The only explanation I thought of was simply that 24 hours out from the diagnosis of the injury, maybe the pain isn't that bad from the corneal abrasion, and so the drops didn't help that much.
A couple of other things we should mention about the studies. There were a number of important exclusions, and we'll put these in the show notes, but some of the really important ones were previous eye surgery, contact lens use, chemical contamination, gross contamination from any foreign body, and inability to follow up in 48 hours.
The need for follow-up is really critical here. You don't want to send these patients out on their own with no one reassessing the eye to ensure they aren't developing an ulcer.
Yeah, that's a really key point that we shouldn't forget. And you appropriately conclude that although the small randomized control trials are promising, they do not prove safety. In general, randomized control trials are not designed or powered to prove safety. Years ago, Jerry Hoffman from Emergency Medical Abstracts actually tried to find ophthalmology researchers as co-investigators for an NIH trial to definitively assess the efficacy and safety of topical anesthetics for corneal abrasions. I was wondering, did you calculate how large a study would need to be to definitively evaluate whether this practice is safe or not?
No, we didn't do a sample size calculation as part of our study.
I was pretty bored today. It was a snow day here in St. Louis, so I actually did a power calculation. And the way I did that is I looked at the Ball study and the Waldman study. So you had almost 200 patients and none of them identified a single adverse outcome. So at a minimum, you need to have 200 patients to get an adverse outcome. So that's 0.05%. Based on an alpha of 0.05, a two-sided alpha, and a beta of 20% or 80% power, and a control group event rate of one quarter of that. So assume that 0.0125% get corneal abrasions who don't get the eye drops. You would need over 700,000 patients enrolled in a controlled study to definitively prove safety for these drops. Nobody's ever going to do that trial.
Yeah, good luck making that happen.
Yeah, no kidding. So yeah, you can't determine it in your systematic review, and probably no future investigators in the near future are going to be able to either. So here's the real question. Would you give a patient with a simple corneal abrasion a prescription for topical tetracaine or proparacaine to go home with for analgesia?
So I would. In patients with uncomplicated corneal abrasions who meet the inclusion criteria of the Waldman paper, I would give them a topical anesthetic for comfort. Typically what I do is sterilely draw up 1 cc of tetracaine 0.5% solution into a syringe of 9 cc's of sterile saline in order to dilute it 10 to 1 so that I now have a 0.05% solution. I then fill the bottle with about 1 to 2 cc's of this solution and give that to the patient to go home with. By doing this, I've only given the patient enough for about a day or so, so I limit the potential for the patient to go home and abuse the medication. So this technique was reviewed on Rebel EM, and we'll put a link to that post in the show notes. Excellent. Finally, I make sure that the patient has 48-hour follow-up, either in the ED or even better with an ophthalmologist.
So I'm doing the same as Kara. I send patients home with a diluted proparacaine with only 48 hours worth, so the 1 to 2 cc's exactly as she described. And I reiterate to them the 48-hour follow-up. And this is really the key part. This is where bad things happen, is when people don't follow up. I literally tell the patient, if you don't follow up, there's a possibility that you're masking something worse going on. You could lose your vision, or worse yet, you could actually lose your eye. And then I think the most important thing is I document that conversation in the chart. And just like everything else in medicine, if you didn't document it, it didn't happen.
That's a real poke in the eye, Salim.
No pun intended.
So, Kara, can you comment on the author's conclusions compared to the ASGEM conclusion?
Yeah, so this is an easy one. Since we're the authors, we agree with our conclusion. We'd love to see more robust data on the topic, and we may see that soon. As part of our research, we were able to contact Neil Waldman, and he let us know that they are currently enrolling patients in a larger prospective study. We'll have to keep our eyes out for that one.
Excellent. The trial that Jerry Hoffman always wanted to conduct but never could. So RTC's randomized controlled trial is assessing the efficacy of any intervention are time-consuming and expensive. Do you know who's paying for Dr. Waldman's ongoing trial?
I do not know who's sponsoring the trial.
Yeah, I tried to look today too, and I couldn't find out either. I did find, however, on clinicaltrials.gov, there's a second trial that's underway by Dr. Robert Bryson at Queen's University comparing tetracaine 0.5% versus normal saline eye drops, just registered in June 2015 after your systematic review came out. Unfortunately, they're only looking at about 260 patients, and they haven't started yet, but yet another trial that we can look forward to. So, Salim, can you bring us home with the ASGEM bottom line?
Yeah, so the best evidence that we currently have demonstrates that dilute topical anesthetic drops of either proparacaine or tetracaine are safe for use in patients with simple corneal abrasions to provide analgesia. The studies are small, but the data contained in them is far superior to the case series published 50 years ago, which led to the dogma that using them is so dangerous.
I think dogma is dangerous in medicine, so I'm glad you guys put this paper together. Kara, can you tell us what the case resolution is of your 23-year-old woman with a corneal abrasion who asked to have topical anesthesia?
Sure. So you discuss the options with the patient for analgesia. She prefers to not take any opioid medications and opts for a short course of dilute topical tetracaine. You schedule her for a follow-up appointment with an ophthalmologist in 2 days.
And what do you tell your patients in the emergency department when you're discussing this with them?
You have a corneal abrasion, which is a scratch on the surface of your eye. This scratch can be quite painful, as you probably know. There are various options available to help control your pain once you leave the emergency department, including topical eye drops and oral pain medications. The advantage of the eye drops is that their effects are limited to the eye, so they cause less body-wide side effects compared to the oral medications. While we don't have robust evidence regarding their use, and further research is definitely needed, the recent studies suggest that they are effective and probably safe, as long as you use them as prescribed and for a short amount of time. Furthermore, it's very important that you follow up with an ophthalmologist within 2 days for your eye to be rechecked.
And lastly, we want to give a shout out to the other authors who worked on this. Also, thanks to Kevin Reed, our medical librarian, who was essential in getting all this together.
Last week's Keener Contest winner was Christopher Mayday from the University of Alabama at Birmingham, home of Blaze the Dragon. He knew that methanol and ethylene glycol are two toxic alcohols that can cause an anti-GAP metabolic acidosis and are highly toxic. So what is this week's Keener Contest question?
Which famous scientist's eyes were removed when he died in 1955 and remain to this day in a safe deposit box in New York City?
Okay, that's pretty bizarre. If you know the answer to this question, send an email to theasgem@gmail.com with Gunner in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Don't forget the Emergency Medical Abstracts Conference in Key West, February 8th through the 12th, Ski Beam Sunbeaks, British Columbia, February 1st through the 3rd, and the SAEM Consensus Conference on May the 10th on shared decision making. Thank you both, Kara and Salim, for this eye-opening insight into your systematic review.
Thanks for having us, Chris.
Thanks for having us on.
It's always great to hear from the authors. Thank you so much. And thanks for doing this research, too. It's not easy. Kara, can you wrap up this edition of the ASGEM with our ASGEM tagline?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
See you later, everybody.